The emphasis of early Christians on the importance of self-realization was first condemned by the Church as heretical, then persecuted, and finally, in time, buried. Writings that emphasized inner communion with God were determinedly destroyed, and so-called true, which is to say, formally recognized Christians, were exhorted to heed only outer authority and to engage only in outer ritual. This was the Church's act of betrayal. It wasn't until the 20th century that long-buried texts were discovered at Nag Hammadi. Though scholars at first kept them from the public eye, they were obliged at last to release them. People who have scrutinized those documents declare that they reveal something quite unexpected, that the ancient so-called Gnostic emphasis on direct communion with God, so long dismissed as heretical, was far more important to early Christians than had hitherto been thought. Indeed, from what Yogananda said about original Christianity, the teaching of the early Gnostics was probably, when stripped of its later distortions, the original true Christianity. This is not to say that all those Gnostic teachings were equally valid. It seems safe to say that, where they depart significantly from the sayings of Jesus in the New Testament, they deserve to be discarded as either suspect or, quite simply, wrong. I have frequently stated elsewhere in my writings that the true custodians of religion are the saints. There were Gnostics and Gnostics. Those alone were true who had attained divine insight or true gnosis. Webster's Third International Dictionary, published in 1961, when the contents of the Nag Hammadi discoveries were still being debated, out of sight of the public, defines Gnosticism as, quote, "the thought and practice of any of various cults of late pre-Christian and early Christian centuries, declared heretical by the Church and distinguished chiefly by pretension to mystic and especially esoteric religious insights, by emphasis on knowledge rather than faith, and by the conviction that matter is evil." The Oxford American Dictionary, published in 1980, does not even contain the word Gnosticism, nor any word related to it, such as Gnosis or Gnostic. If we could go to Jesus himself, there would be no need to look to scholars for explanations of his original teachings, nor is there any need now to go to scholars for explanations of Gnosticism, about which present-day information is in any case vague. Since we have Yogananda's explanation of the original teachings of Jesus Christ, for Yogananda was himself a great master. However, the issue here is not even whether his explanation was correct. Rather, it is that since he did explain them, his disciples have a spiritual duty to abide by that explanation. Unfortunately, the history of his organization shows already a tendency to enclose his teachings in a straitjacket. Such indeed was the betrayal Yogananda imputed to the Christian churches. Alas, he himself said to Dayamata, "How you all will change my work." In early Christianity, disciples who wanted a personal inward relationship with Christ and God were persecuted by an institution that was determined to subject them to its control. The Church insisted that if people's emphasis on a direct relationship with God were not brought under rigid control, of course in time it was suppressed altogether, the Church would lose any say in what practices were permissible. Who, then, the Church Fathers asked, could be certain what the teachings of Jesus really were? The solution they settled on was to ban as heretical the claim that anyone could speak, as Gandhi did in India, with inner God-given authority. Authority became vested in the Pope. Martin Luther's Reformation caused Protestants to invest it in Scripture itself. This, however, was a disastrous development, for it removed altogether the possibility of a wise, living authority, and led inescapably to the conclusion that truth depends on majority agreement. Thus, any interpretation of Scripture is admissible, provided only that enough people fancy it. SRF today has introduced a new paradigm, one very different from that which Yogananda originally, and I should add, fervently, proposed. Surely SRF's actions, and the justification SRF offers for those actions, are identical with those of the Church, which has crucified Christ by insisting that it has a monopoly on Christ's teachings. The Church enforced its claim by persecuting all whom it considered heretics. The lengths to which SRF has gone to achieve the same ends are extraordinary. SRF, too, has persecuted others in the name of, quote, protecting the purity of the teachings, end quote. I see some justification for self-defense when one is under attack. I can see none for destroying people whose motives are pacific and harmonious, and who merely want to serve God as they are guided to do from within and as they are able. Kamala Silva, for example, wrote a beautiful book of reminiscences on her life with Paramhansa Yogananda. She was denounced by SRF, not because the book itself was objectionable, but only because it was written without SRF's sanction. Many such examples might be cited. Perhaps it is enough to cite the fact that I myself was denounced without being given an opportunity to defend myself, that I had projected onto me motives I knew were not true, that my right to continue serving my guru, either within or outside the organization, was denied, and that I have been persecuted for more than 40 years because I wouldn't simply turn my back on them as most people in my shoes would have done. SRF's accusations against me are based entirely on the fact that my continued devotion to my guru and to his teachings is an embarrassment to them. They have shown themselves to be more concerned with saving face than with compassion or with truth. When Dayamata asked me to declare publicly that I had resigned from SRF, to which request I replied, "I can't, it isn't true, and you know it isn't true," she said, unbelievably, "Well, you should have resigned." SRF would like to say that I have changed the teachings. In fact, it is they who have changed them, and in some respects fundamentally. Unknowledgeable people have asked us, why did Ananda take Krishna off its altars? Ananda never took Krishna off its altars. SRF added him. Most people are unaware of the numerous ways SRF has changed Master's work during Dayamata's presidency. The addition of Krishna to its altars is at least understandable, since Yogananda and Lahiri Mahashai before him said that Babaji was Krishna in a former life. Another change is less understandable, the spelling of Yogananda's title Paramhansa, Paramhansa. Yogananda himself wrote it that way. SRF added an A in the middle of it, thus Paramahansa. Both spellings are encountered in India. The problem with that extra A, apart from the fact that in Yogananda's printed signature, it has necessitated copying another part of the same signature, a glaring forgery, is that it also forces Westerners to mispronounce the word. For with all those A's staring at them, they feel the need to linger on the middle one, as if gathering strength to move on to the finish. Paramahansa. An Indian, on the other hand, sails over that A as if it didn't exist. Thus, that is to say, most Indians don't pronounce it at all. Particularly offensive to me personally, however, is the fact that the change which Tara accepted on the advice of a pundit in India showed Tara herself willing to take a stranger's word over that of her own guru. To me, this shows her inclination, already evident from other statements of hers, to belittle Master's linguistic ability from a tendency to pride herself on her own. And this pride of hers is worrying when one thinks of the editing she did on his works during her final years. These are all minor points, however, relatively speaking. In view of the many and much graver changes SRF has introduced into his books, teachings, and policies, Autobiography of a Yogi has been subjected to so many changes that Ananda, having won from the courts, as you shall see presently, the right to republish that book, has felt it a duty to make the first edition once more available to people. New editions contain over 100 editions of the organization's name, many of them obviously with the particular purpose of promoting the organization itself. Yogananda's original references to communities have been removed, as well as any hint of his enthusiasm for them. There are substantive changes in the text, such as the new statement that only SRF-approved ministers may give Kriya Yoga initiation. What Yogananda originally wrote was, quote, "The actual technique must be learned from a Kriyaban or Kriya Yogi," end quote. A significant change appears also in a passage comparing the path of the yogi householder to that of a swami. The first edition of the book says, quote, "To fulfill one's earthly responsibilities," that is to say as a householder, not as a renunciate, "to fulfill one's earthly responsibilities is indeed the higher path, provided the yogi, maintaining a mental uninvolvement with egotistical desires, plays his part as a willing instrument of God," end quote. This passage was changed in the mid-1950s, as I happen to know personally, having discussed the matter at the time with Tara. It now reads, quote, "Fulfilling one's earthly responsibilities need not separate man from God, provided," etc. So the first said, "To fulfill one's earthly responsibilities is indeed the higher path, provided," etc. The next is, "Fulfilling one's earthly responsibilities need not separate man," indicating, therefore, obviously, that the householder path is lower than the renunciate, not what Master said. These are examples only of the kind of alterations I mean, all of them intended to increase the authority of Self-Realization Fellowship in the dissemination and practice of Yogananda's teachings. Another quite amazing change is the exclusion of at least a quarter of his great poem Samadhi from the autobiography. As for his enthusiasm for communities, SRF downplays it, actually saying, as they do to justify so many changes, quote, "He changed his mind at the end." Once, however, he declared during a public lecture, "Last night I was thinking so much about communities that I wasn't able to meditate. Then I chanted to God, and my mind came back to me." End quote. Two chapters ago, I pointed out the drastic re-editing Tara did on Whispers from Eternity. That, too, must be listed among the substantive changes SRF has sanctioned. A word that is frequently used by SRF is, quote, "the blueprint," as if Yogananda had sat the directors down and dictated to them his exact wishes for the work. He did nothing of the kind. "The blueprint," he used to say, "is in the ether. The pattern," quote, "ordained by God," as he expressed it to Dr. Lewis, "remained for his disciples to work out. Even in the responsibilities he gave me personally, which were considerable, He left it mostly to me to tune into his will and apply it according to my own ability to perceive it. If I needed help, he supplied it, but his way with his disciples was to help them develop their own intuition. The so-called blueprint, then, is simply an organizational ploy for exercising control. In 1990, SRF instituted a lawsuit against me and Ananda, claiming it had a monopoly on its name and the right to prevent me from quoting anything of Yogananda's, mind you, my own guru's, without their permission. At the present writing, January 2001, nearly 11 years since the suit was filed, the case is not yet completely over, though we've won almost everything. So far, SRF has forced us to spend some $5 million in defending ourselves. Could we have simply reacted to their charges by ignoring them? People occasionally ask us this question. The simple answer is no. How we wish it had been possible. SRF took their lawsuit to the courts of the land, demanding legal sanctions against us. To ignore them would have meant forfeiting the right to continue serving our guru as his disciples. To submit would have been to admit publicly that they alone have the right to speak on his behalf. It would have meant surrendering any such right ourselves. SRF's leaders have done their best to win by bringing us to financial ruin. In the process, they have used endless delaying tactics and caused us to spend more and more money. Every time they've lost a point, they've appealed it, ineffectively for the most part, to the higher courts. So far, the outcome has been quite different from what they intended. They have lost the right to a monopoly on their name. They have lost their claim to ownership of Yogananda's writings. Ananda, meanwhile, has been fighting like David fighting Goliath. For SRF is enormously wealthy, and Ananda simply is not. Still, we have so far won almost everything, but the struggle unfortunately goes on. Will it go further after we win everything? Are there other ways they can persecute us? The answer is in God's hands. We are open to his will no matter what tests he sends us. In 1997, I wrote Dayamata to say that the judge had declared, finally, that he was going to give us both an opportunity now, as he put it, to practice your own teachings. You'll have to decide these last matters for yourselves. In my letter to Daya, I wrote, Ananda has no desire to gloat over your defeat. We've no wish to declare ourselves victorious, for that would imply that you were the losers. How much better it would be if both of us could declare to the world, we've agreed to the following. We could list the points on which we'd agreed so that what emerged would be perceived as a joint agreement between us. End quote. This would, I said, demonstrate harmony between us as fellow disciples of the same great guru. Dayamata agreed to meet us in Pasadena. It was a wonderful reunion, harmonious, loving, an outspoken recognition of the deep bond between us. Always my dream had been that we would work in harmony together, spreading Master's mission of love. Ananda's view of the teachings, however, seems never to have been the same as SRF's. This fact was revealed clearly by what followed that meeting. Daya has always seen the teachings in terms of centralized control, whereas I have always seen them in terms of spiritual needs. Thus, even though our meeting in Pasadena was harmonious, SRF assumed from the love we expressed then that we intended to cede back to them everything we'd gained in the case. To us, this construction which they placed on our love was hardly believable. Diamata said to me at that meeting, with reference to their persecution of me, "It has never been personal." Needless to say, the person being persecuted is not so easily inclined to see that persecution impersonally. Still, I know what she meant. The issues involved are, in her mind, more important than any individual's life and reputation. A dubious claim, of course, in light of Yogananda's statement, "Only love can take my place." I am reminded of a movie in which a lawyer comments on some villain's threat to destroy Los Angeles. "I think we need to define what we mean by destroy." End quote. Jesus Christ said, "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much." Luke 16:10. The saying, "I love humanity, it's my neighbors I can't stand," seems fitting in this context. The Catholic Church has used a rationale similar to Daya's in its explanation of the Inquisition, which it still justifies. A recent Vatican item in a secular newspaper in Italy praised Torquemada on the anniversary of his birth. Torquemada, I ask you, the butcher of the Spanish Inquisition. It described him as a humble, devout monk, whose only desire was to protect the faith. Nothing personal in that, of course. When Torquemada burned people at the stake, we were asked to believe that he did it in God's name, and that his was an act of love. For the Church, of course, not for human beings, but anyway, without animus, so the Church claims, toward the sufferers he tortured and killed. Such is the story. If one steps on an ant, the act is quite probably impersonal. Still, one wonders how the ant sees it. SRF, however, has stepped on this particular ant with such grim determination that it makes the stepping itself seem directed with great and very personal feeling. Is it true that SRF's persecution of Ananda has been impersonal? Hardly. Diamata wrote me that it has all been to defend a principle. What principle? No mere institution can be a principle. A principle is, by very definition, abstract. Their exercise of hegemony, too, reveals considerable personal attachment. Much has been said and done by SRF and its members to discredit Ananda. All quite impersonally, no doubt. We ourselves, however, have had to fight for our lives. If Master had wanted the organization to be his entire spiritual legacy, I would sincerely embrace it as such, aware that my own understanding, being human, cannot but be fallible. I cannot see, however, that their claim is supported by anything he ever said, did, or wrote. Wishing to demonstrate complete loyalty to my guru, however, I actually offered 2 or 3 times to give Ananda to Self-Realization Fellowship. This may seem extraordinary for one in my position, but I made the offer not because I'd had any change of heart toward Ananda, and certainly not out of any sense of guilt toward SRF. Indeed, Ananda represents for me the culmination of my life's work. It might also be fairly considered a vindication and a triumph for me personally, especially in light of the things Tara said against me. I offered Ananda to SRF with the simple thought, "This has never been my work. It is Master's. If by any chance it should end up becoming SRF's, I would relinquish it gladly." To underscore my complete non-attachment, I offered even to leave Ananda forever and never give it a backward glance. Obviously, Ananda members themselves would have had to be consulted and their feelings taken into account. As a formal proposal, therefore, my offer was contingent on the will of others. not only on my own will. The important thing then to me was that I be completely willing to leave everything, if such should happen to be my Guru's will. What became of me personally thereafter would, I felt, be entirely in his hands. Simplicity, however, is not often understood. Ananda itself has been simple in its motivation regarding SRF's lawsuits. Whatever you want, we have prayed to God and our gurus, we will accept with love. Dayamata herself led us in a similar prayer in Fresno in 1990, before the formal filing of their lawsuit. When decision after decision went against them, however, they appealed, and appealed again, and then yet again. In the end, they submitted the matter to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court returned it, rejecting the appeal, in what appears to me as record time. Daya's prayer might perhaps have been better stated, "Master, may your will be done, provided it agrees with mine." The first time I offered Ananda to SRF was in 1972. Dayamata replied then, "We'll see." Nothing happened. Later I made the same offer by letter, to which a variety of responses came from SRF's representatives, none of them positive. Their general tone suggested that I was being merely irresponsible. The third time I offered, Dayamata replied, "We wouldn't want to inherit your debts." Could she possibly believe that Ananda was teetering on the verge of collapse? Disappointed at the meaning implied in her answer, I replied, "And I wouldn't want to give you Ananda if I thought you would run it into the ground." Daya once said to me, "It isn't the good people of Ananda I have anything against, it's Kriyananda. To me, the only thing that matters is that we have the freedom to serve our Guru's mission." SRF had raised me in the thought that the organization was his work. Ananda members, on the other hand, have never shared this scruple. I myself have seen from SRF's very narrowness that the scope of his mission is far, far broader. Ananda, to us now, has been and always will be a part of Master's work, that is to say, of his overall mission. Our members are directly acquainted with SRF, for it is not very far from Ananda's California communities, and many have gone there. I have often said to people, "Visit SRF, see for yourselves, then draw your own conclusions." Most of them have chosen Ananda, though I have not influenced them to do so. Their choice is not grudging, a sort of compromise or necessary substitute for SRF. Many have told me, quote, "I would never have become Master's disciple except through Ananda," end quote. Most of them add, "Their way simply doesn't attract me." In the eyes of God, I believe they are right to follow their soul guidance. Still, I have given them perfect freedom to make that discovery for themselves. SRF's denunciations of me have been surprisingly personal. They have denounced me to the courts as, quote, "an interloper." They have attempted to defame my character, my discipleship, my spiritual and moral integrity, my right to speak on behalf of my guru. I'm sure they feel, however, that none of this is, quote, "personal." They have repeatedly rejected my attempts to bring unity between SRF and Ananda, but have not shown the slightest qualm about trying to steal Ananda members or even Ananda itself away from me whenever they've seen a hope of fomenting trouble between us. Do these attempts reflect Master's counsel to Dayamata, "Only love can take my place"? In my heart, and I'm sure in the hearts of all Ananda members, there is deep love and fellow feeling for the members of SRF, for its renunciates and lay members alike. We deeply desire harmony with them, and would willingly forget all past hurts unhesitatingly in the name of love. If truth is needed to clear the air, and such is presently, I believe, the case, we speak it with sorrow and with unchanging love. If by any chance their attempts to destroy us should prove successful, we would love them still. Until now, however, our efforts to win them with love have only meant a hardening of their animus toward us. I cannot but think that the consequence for them has been their spiritual and institutional loss. One point stands out, however, in their efforts to undermine Ananda. If a person seeks victory by honorable means, it may be that he is merely mistaken, in which case he cannot be held spiritually culpable. If, however, he seeks victory by dishonest and underhanded means, there can be no justification for his actions. In such a case, indeed, he can only be considered dishonorable. SRF has lied. Dayamata herself has lied. Dayamata has asked me, too, to lie in order to protect SRF's name. The tactics their lawyers have used, which SRF has endorsed, have been what other lawyers themselves call despicable. This aspect of the story is so sordid that I cannot even bring myself to describe it in detail. There is another instance here of karmic repetition. The early Christians are known to have gathered into small spiritual communities, intentional in the sense that their members shared the same beliefs, practices, and ideals. Why does history tell us so little about those communities? From all indications, they were successful. The inevitable conclusion, surely, is that they were suppressed along with the Gnostics. Indeed, autonomous communities can only have been considered a threat by the Church in its determination to impose control on its members. It is for similar reasons, surely, that SRF is not happy with Ananda's existence. Since communities would certainly have been inconvenient to the newly organized Christian Church, it seems probably for this reason that references to those early communities were suppressed, along with the Gnostic writings. Yet what could have been more natural than for Jesus to want people to live together in communities, practicing together the teachings he had given them? At any rate, Paramhansa Yogananda himself urged people all his life to form communities, and SRF, like the early Church, has set itself against this idea. Daya once said to me, when I raised this subject, quote, "Frankly, I'm not interested," end quote. In 1988, to celebrate our 20th anniversary, a group of 200 members went from Ananda to visit SRF's main centers in Southern California. On the grounds at Encinitas, the nun in charge, Sister Shanti, stated to a group of us, "Oh, I know many people have tried to start communities, but none of them have succeeded." 200 people, celebrating 20 years of successful existence, and she could say that to us. Her very statement makes it clear, however, that SRF has no serious intention of ever starting the communities for which Master campaigned so ardently. Yogananda himself tried to start a community in Encinitas. His hopes were not destined to be fulfilled during his lifetime, and I cannot help thinking that one reason the venture was abandoned was owing to resistance by some of his monastic disciples. Even so, until the end of his life, he kept urging people to form communities. His last known plea on the point came only 4 months before he left his body. Kamala Silva reported it in her book, The Flawless Mirror, from a conversation she had had with him during her visit to Mount Washington. It has been my own lot to fulfill Yogananda's communitarian dream. Ananda now consists of 6 communities, 5 in America and 1 in Italy, with a 7th underway in Rhode Island. An ancient karmic pattern is reemerging through Ananda's striking success story, a repetition of the trend begun long ago among the early Christians. I've pointed out SRF's attempt to freeze the mission of Yogananda. SRF seeks to exercise rigid control over its members who go along with that attempt in the sincere belief that such was Paramahansa Yogananda's desire. His wish, certainly, was that his disciples love one another and not fight one another. I myself have been turning the other cheek for decades. Can I continue to do so now with integrity, in the face of renewed attacks by them? Master told us not to be doormats for others. Self-respect and respect for truth itself demands that I defend myself and Ananda with love, yes, but firmly. What Ananda stands for is an attempt, paralleling that of the Gnostics and the early Christians, to simplify matters and to center the teachings in the individual's own self-realization. To Dhyamata, we and everyone who disagrees with her are, to quote a favorite expression of hers, pipsqueaks. In my belief and Ananda's, all of us, including Daya herself, are children of God, heirs in equal right to soul freedom in Him. Again, there is a growing insistence within SRF that the strictly monastic life is the only way to serve Yogananda and spread his teachings. Many of his close disciples, however, were or had been married. Suppression of non-monastic communities is another indication of a historic karmic pattern. The struggle between inner spirituality and churchified spirituality is being repeated in the struggle between SRF and Ananda. I myself deeply believe in the monastic ideal. I, too, am a monk. And despite many attempts by SRF and its members to deride my monastic calling, I am firmly committed to it. Monasticism sets an example to devotees everywhere that the spiritual life must be founded at least on inner renunciation. I have, however, seen a measure of arrogance among renunciates in their calling that I heard Yogananda himself also deplore. In about 1970, some of the members of Ananda expressed a desire to start a monastery. Though I encouraged them, it was with trepidation, for I realized that men and women living in the same community would probably not succeed in persevering in that calling. In fact, the monastery did not endure permanently, at least in that form. What came out of it eventually, however, was a new kind of monastic order, including householders dedicated to the traditional monastic ideals of non-attachment, simplicity, service, and self-control. Such a community, I find, is an inspiration to people everywhere at a time when most monasteries in the world are empty. It inspires, moreover, in a way that communities that are exclusively monastic in the traditional sense of not achieved, or at least are not achieving nowadays. People at every stage of life are encouraged to be devotees wholeheartedly. This pattern of life was first established by Lahiri Mahasaya. Paramahansa Yogananda approved of it and indeed recommended it for most people. I had to set the pattern myself. Such, it seems, has always been my job at Ananda for monastic householdership. Seeing many Ananda members burdened with feelings of guilt that they couldn't be renunciates, I deliberately chose marriage for myself. This step was, of course, for me a serious risk. But I felt that I could accept the married state now without losing my inner spirit of renunciation. My marriage completely changed the community. Everyone since then has felt a pure dedication to God and to doing God's will. Our teachers and ministers, householders all, are the best I've encountered in any spiritual community. As for myself, God saw to it that the marriage didn't last. I am grateful for what I gained from it. I am grateful He took the burden from me. At no time, I am glad to say, did I feel any personal attachment to it. I was, and am, and always will be, a monk at heart above all. Ananda has already broken many karmic patterns of the past. A new pattern is emerging instead, one of personal spiritual freedom, similar to the system since ancient times in India, where no organization tried to control people's spiritual quest. In India, far more so than in the West, the purity of the spiritual teachings has been maintained by the spontaneous devotion of sincere individuals. Above all, it has been maintained by the repeated manifestation on its soil of great saints. India's is the final, complete disproof of any claim that an organization is needed to uphold the purity of high teachings. Ananda's, then, is a success story, gloriously so. Many thousands of lives have been changed, even by simple contact with it. I never forget, however, where that success comes from. It comes not from this simple, mere human being, but from God, and from the blessings that fill our hearts from our great gurus.